our Pediatric Cardiology Today. My name is Dr. Robert Pass, and I'm the host of this podcast. I am Professor of Pediatrics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, where I am the Chief of Pediatric Cardiology. Thank you very much for joining me for this 240th episode of the podcast. I hope everybody enjoyed last week's 239th episode on the topic of white matter injury trends over time in neonates undergoing congenital heart surgery. We spoke with Dr. Shabnam Payvandi of UCSF about this important topic, and for those of you interested in neurodevelopmental outcomes, I definitely recommend you take a listen to last week's episode 239. As I say most weeks, if you'd like to get in touch with me, it's easy to remember my email. It's pediheart@gmail.com. This week, move on to the world of electrophysiology. The title of the work we'll be reviewing is Atrial Standstill in the Pediatric Population, a Multi-Institutional Collaboration. The first author of this work is Taylor Howard, and the senior author is Christina Miyake, and the authors come from multiple centers, but the first and last authors come to us from Texas Children's Hospital, Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. When we're done reviewing the paper, Dr. Taylor Howard, the first author of this work, has graciously agreed to speak with us about it. Therefore, let's move on to this interesting paper and then a conversation with its first author. Before we get into the article, I just want to apologize in advance for the slightly reduced sound quality this week. For those of you who live on the East Coast of the United States, you probably know that it is freezing this week in the East Coast, and the area where I normally record the podcast is a basic meat locker, and for this reason I'm recording it in a different location, and so the sound may be marginally less good, and for this I apologize. This week we review a fairly unusual and rare topic that many in the audience may never have seen, or perhaps seen just once or twice, and that is the topic of so-called atrial standstill. The authors describe this as a transient or persistent absence of discernible electrical activity in the atria, and though there are temporary causes of this condition like digoxin toxicity, myocarditis, or even infarction, more permanent cases can be associated with forms of muscular dystrophy, but also with some inherited cardiac arrhythmia conditions with variants in the SCN5A gene, encoding the cardiac sodium channel NAV1.5. The authors explain that there's a true paucity of data on this condition given its rarity, and though there is at least theoretical reason to worry about thrombus and embolization in this condition, the data on just how worried we ought to be about this has been, until this work, largely unknown. And so with this as a background, the authors explain that the purpose of this work was, to use their words, to describe the clinical presentations, genetic associations, and clinical courses of pediatric patients with atrial standstill that is not attributable to another condition, with particular attention to thrombotic complications. This was a retrospective multicenter study with patients in 8 different centers in the United States, Canada, and Denmark. And the inclusion criteria was a diagnosis of atrial standstill prior to the age of 18 years. And for the purpose of this study, atrial standstill was defined as the absence of atrial electrical activity determined or documented during an EP study, device placement like a pacemaker or defibrillator, or on non-invasive rhythm tracings, in addition to demonstration of a lack of mechanical activity on echocardiogram. And the authors demonstrate a nice example of this in Figure 1, in which there's a voltage map from electroanatomical mapping showing nearly the entire atrium with voltages less than 0.1 millivolts, which is essentially no electrical activity, as well as a Doppler interrogation of a mitral valve in someone with this condition in which there is no A wave demonstrable. If a patient had waxing and waning of the standstill, they would be included as long as there were long periods of quiescence of the atria. In order to keep this work a clean one with sort of lone atrial standstill, the authors limited the inclusion to patients who did not have other conditions that can be associated with atrial standstill, including such things as congenital heart disease, myocarditis, or muscular dystrophy. Genetic data as well as all clinical data were collected, but it's important to note that there was no kind of central lab, and so the authors were basically accepting as fact the reported data from the various centers and not verifying it centrally. And on to the results. There were a total of 20 patients in this study, with 65% or 13 being male. The median age at diagnosis was 6.6 years, within its quartile range of 2.9 to 10.8 years. The median follow-up in this cohort was 7 years, and the composition of the group ethnically was 50% non-Hispanic white, 25% Hispanic, and 25% Asian. 8 of the 20 patients in this group had signs or symptoms at the presentation,
including 5 with arrhythmia, 1 with palpitations, 1 with syncope, and 1 who had a stroke. 1 had a family history of arrhythmia, 1 had an irregular heartbeat, and the remaining 10 had just bradycardia as a presenting sign that was not symptomatic. 45% had a family history of arrhythmias, a need for pacing, or sudden death, and 6 had a family history of atrial standstill or SA node dysfunction. The authors state that the major driver for this diagnosis was an EP study or pacemaker implantation in which no atrial activity was seen in combination with an echocardiogram showing an absence of mechanical activity. And what did their ECGs show on presentation? Well, perhaps not surprisingly, 2/3 or 13 had junctional rhythm without atrial activity. 1 had a ventricular escape rhythm. 2 or 10% had atrial fibrillation or flutter. 2 had ventricular tachycardia, and 2 presented with sinus rhythm and complete AV block. The majority had structurally normal hearts, though 1 had an ASD, and 1 had an ASD and VSD. Importantly, 3 patients had LV non-compaction, 1 had restrictive cardiomyopathy, and 7 patients had systolic dysfunction at some point in follow-up. Because of the number of patients in this study being very small, there are tables that demonstrate details about every single one of the 20 patients. And for those of you who have more curiosity about this patient group, certainly, as usual, I'd recommend you take a look at the paper, and it'll be linked to in the show notes. And so what were the main findings of importance in this work? First, genetic testing showed an SCN5A variant in 65% of the patients in this work. An analysis of these defects or variants suggested that loss of function seemed to be a mechanism driving this standstill. The authors show us in Figure 4 a nice schematic representation of the NaV1.5 channel and the amino acid changes that were associated with atrial standstill in this work. And for those interested, again, I reference the paper. Second, and perhaps most importantly, fully 35%, or 7 patients, experienced a major thromboembolic event at a median follow-up of 6.9 years. Of these 7 patients, 5 had strokes, 1 a TIA, and 1 had a right atrial thrombus, and 1 of the stroke victims died a week later following stroke. Importantly, none of the patients with the thromboembolic event was on anticoagulation at the time of the event, and none had atrial pacing or activity, though 1 patient was on aspirin. All of these patients had a history of atrial arrhythmia at some point, but in no case was an atrial arrhythmia considered to be the cause, but rather the simple standstill of the atrium. Again, let me emphasize, no one on anticoagulation had an event, and all the patients who had an event were not being treated with anticoagulation. Third, pacemakers were implanted in 90% of the patients in this work, or 18 of the 20 patients, and atrial pacing was attempted in the majority, or 15 of the 18. But basically, the majority could not achieve atrial captured implants, and even though a few rare patients, 4, could have an atrial lead placed, ultimately, at last follow-up, only 3 of the 15 patients in whom atrial pacing was at least attempted had atrial pacing documented, meaning that only 3 of 15 patients in whom it was attempted ended up in follow-up with a functional atrial lead. Fourth, the majority had arrhythmias other than bradycardia, with 80% or 16 of 20 having an atrial or supraventricular arrhythmia, and 8 having VT, including 4 cardiac arrests. It's interesting to note that 4 of the patients had a Brugada pattern at one point or another, which is perhaps not shocking given the association with SCN5A mutations seen in this work. The authors state that ventricular arrhythmias or arrests were most commonly seen in patients who had biallelic SCN5A mutations. In their discussion, the authors re-emphasized the findings of SCN5A loss of function mutations in a large number of patients, which is a new observation. They speak of the large number of atrial arrhythmias and how this is somewhat unexpected given that the primary issue is that of atrial standstill, and they state that there is not an obvious mechanistic explanation for this. They also comment on the 4 patients who had a cardiac arrest and follow-up and how they either had homozygous or compound heterozygous SCN5A variants, suggesting again that biallelic variants may have worse clinical courses. They also note that 1 of the 4 patients who arrested even had effective atrial pacing and yet still arrested, and so it may not be actual atrial standstill that is the risk. The authors comment that given the few patient numbers in this work, it's difficult to make any sort of recommendations regarding medical therapy, but they wonder if avoidance of sodium channel blockers may make sense given the prevalence of SCN5A loss of function in these patients. The authors then comment on the fact that 7 of the patients in this work had systolic dysfunction and 1 had restrictive physiology, and they mention how cardiomyopathy has been well described to be associated with some SCN5A variants, and also how LV non-compaction is also associated sometimes with this variant, and there were 3 patients in the cohort who met criteria for that diagnosis. Though it is hard to draw any conclusions amongst these patients with standstill and dysfunction, it seems reasonable, based upon these findings, to proceed with intermittent echocardiograms to surveil for dysfunction. The authors then comment on the pacemaker lead placement woes of the operators, explaining how so few were able to get a functional atrial wire, but how some had intermittent versus complete standstill, and some had partial versus complete standstill, and how rarely, with a lot of effort, the implanter was able to find a spot from which to pace. Finally, the authors speak about the very high rate of thrombotic complications in these patients, and they emphasize the finding that all of the patients had persistent atrial standstill without an ability to atrially pace. They mention also, once more, how all were on no antithrombotic therapy, with the exception of 1 patient who was on aspirin. They also comment that there were 8 patients on anticoagulation or antiplatelet therapy as primary prevention, and how 7 of the 8 have not had an event in follow-up. They state that with these small numbers, it's not possible to make any strong recommendations, but they do believe that an aggressive approach with warfarin or a direct oral anticoagulant may be considered, particularly since the patient on aspirin did have a stroke. In regard to limitations, the authors point to the retrospective nature of this work and the absence of a central adjudication center to agree upon the diagnosis of atrial standstill, meaning that the study essentially relied upon the word of the participating electrophysiologist in regards to patient detail. They speak also of the small numbers and the inconsistency of the data, meaning that partial or total atrial standstill could not be discerned in all patients. And so they conclude, patients with primary atrial standstill demonstrate lack of atrial contraction as well as atrial and ventricular arrhythmias. Patients without atrial activity and ability for atrial pacing are at particular risk for thromboembolic events and warrant primary prevention anticoagulation. Many atrial standstill patients may harbor loss of function SCN5A variants. Those with biallelic SCN5A variants seem to be at particular risk for Brugada ECG pattern, ventricular arrhythmias, and cardiac arrest. Atrial sensing and capture are likely to be a challenge during lead implantation, and capture threshold may vary and even result in complete loss of capture, particularly during febrile events. Therefore, pre-procedural planning, potential complications, and long-term management strategies should be carefully considered for this population. Well, this is certainly an interesting report on something that is quite rare. We all know that there are patients who are known to have associated atrial standstill, and one example would be patients with Emery-Dreifuss muscular dystrophy. I'm not 1,000% certain I believe that all of the patients in this report are, shall we say, pure atrial standstill patients, as a large number have some form of cardiomyopathy, and so I'm not totally convinced that there is something vastly different between these patients and some others that have standstill with other more well-known secondary findings, such as those who have muscular dystrophy. That said, there are a large number of potential lessons here, with probably the most important immediate one being that of the risk of stroke or thromboembolic complications and the need for something more than antiplatelet agents. That seems from this report to be a major finding that is probably quite reasonable. I do wonder whether it makes sense to try and place atrial leads in these patients, or perhaps might make more sense to take an in-between approach of first doing a voltage map prior to pacemaker surgery in order to confirm the presence of atrial activity that would allow for a pacemaker placement and avoid the need for a long open wounds procedure in the cath lab while placing a pacemaker. I also am somewhat worried about the patients who've had a cardiac arrest and how we know who deserves an ICD for primary prevention. Thus, a lot of things to consider, and so let's move on to our guest and see if we can get a few of those questions answered. Joining us now is this week's first author, Dr. Taylor Howard. Dr. Howard is an attending physician in the pacing and EP group at the Texas Children's Hospital. He is a graduate of the University of Texas Medical Branch and completed his residency at Boston Children's Hospital, followed by fellowship in cardiology at Baylor College of Medicine. He is now an assistant professor of pediatrics at Baylor and it is a great pleasure and honor to welcome him to the podcast. Welcome, Dr. Howard.
I'm here now with Dr. Taylor Howard of Texas Children's Hospital. Taylor, thank you so much for joining us this week on the podcast.
Dr. Pass, I appreciate you inviting me to be on.
Real pleasure. Very much enjoyed this very interesting paper on a very rare topic. I'm wondering if we could start, Dr. Howard, by just, you know, for the audience listening who mostly are not electrophysiologists, could you, for them, define what you mean by atrial standstill and maybe distinguish it from people who may have sinus node dysfunction? And maybe also, if you could, give us a little overview of what was known about this rare condition before your work.
Sure thing. So sinus node dysfunction is usually defined as an inadequate SA nodal function to meet a patient's heart rate needs. So these patients have atrial impulses, but there is chronotropic incompetence. Atrial standstill, on the other hand, is a rare condition characterized by the absence of atrial activity altogether. So this is usually demonstrated by the absence of P waves on electrograms and the absence of A waves on Doppler evaluation of the mitral valve. And patients typically have a resting bradycardia with a junctional or ventricular escape rhythm. There have been various causations like myocardial ischemia and myocarditis, digitalis toxicity. And in these cases, it's a potentially reversible condition, but it's also been reported in associations with things like muscular dystrophies and other genetic mutations, such as SCN5A loss of function mutations, where it's not thought to be reversible. And so when we're speaking about from the perspective of a non-reversible cause, so there's no official classifications, but one of the things that we described in our cohort that's been described elsewhere is that atrial standstill can be a permanent condition, meaning it's always in standstill, or it can be transient, which may better be termed as kind of waxing and waning, long periods of inactivity followed by occasional atrial activity. And it can be partial or complete, meaning if you did a voltage map of these individuals, you would potentially see a complete lack of depolarization in the atria, or there might be islands of tissue that has some depolarization ability. It's likely a spectrum illness, as most things are, and I also look at atrial standstill as something that has potential to progress. And one other thing, at risk of being kind of overly enthusiastic with my first answer out of the box here, one of the fascinating aspects of these patients is that we described in our paper and has been seen in others as well, is that they have a pretty high burden of arrhythmias, both atrial and ventricular. And so despite spending much of their time with complete atrial standstill, there can be bursts of atrial activity as well that is often abnormal and is often a cause of presentation for these kiddos.
You know, it's interesting that you observed that in your study because, of course, that has been seen in other conditions associated with atrial standstill that you excluded from your study. For example, I think of patients with Emery-Dreifuss muscular dystrophy who do develop atrial standstill, but before they do, they often have atrial arrhythmias, and I've certainly seen that in my own experience. One of the clear messages of your work is that anyone who has this condition probably should be treated either with a DOAC, a NOAC, or a warfarin. I'm wondering if you believe that the same should be done for patients who have atrial standstill from other conditions, just as what we were talking about, muscular dystrophy, Costello syndrome, things of that nature, where we know that there is an association, but patients who maybe you excluded from this study because you were looking at more of a, shall we say, a pure atrial standstill group. Do you think these other patients deserve that type of therapy as well, based on what you've observed in your study and the high incidence of thromboembolic complications?
Yeah, it's a good question. I can't speak with data here, but my opinion is I do think that patients with Costello or muscular dystrophy should be considered for higher levels of anticoagulation, especially if they're unable to achieve atrial pacing. So, and in general, I think, you know, a lot of these patients, as you well know, Dr. Pass, are at higher risk for device implant, given the burden of their underlying illness. And so if you're unable to achieve atrial pacing, I think that their risk of a major thrombotic event is higher. than the normal population. And I would discuss anticoagulation with them.
Yeah, yeah. I think I would probably agree, particularly after the frightening results you report. I'm wondering, Dr. Howard, how do you decide which of these patients actually need a pacemaker? In most of the patients in your cohort did get a pacemaker of some sort. Do all atrial standstill patients need a pacemaker? Do any of them have an adequate ventricular escape rate? Or is it pretty much the norm that the vast majority do need some kind of pacing?
Yeah, I think it is probably the latter. And in most cases, this kind of the issue takes care of itself. But it, speaking particularly to our cohort, 18 out of 20 had pacemakers. And most of these patients met criteria for pacing by either having symptomatic bradycardia or other arrhythmias that required some sort of device support. The two patients that were managed without devices did have an adequate narrow escape rhythm, and I think they've done well to my knowledge. But I guess to answer your question more directly, in general, I do think it's worth a try at pacing. While it's certainly the minority, I think there are some of these patients that can be paced, and I do think that this provides a layer of protection against major thrombotic events. Nice. I think that there's also probably some implicit benefit to device support and in the way of backup pacing for pauses that we've seen in this group, as well as gaining some margin for antiarrhythmics, which are commonly needed. But again, I caution folks that this is, you know, atrial standstill is a progressive disease, in my opinion. And so just because you can pace at one time does not mean that it'll be a long-term solution for you. So you have to follow them very closely as well.
Well, just picking up on that point, I think we would agree that if you could pace the atrium with some reliability in this patient group, as you just said, it would probably be a benefit for them. But reading your report, it certainly seemed that pacing the atrium was very challenging and almost impossible in the vast majority. And I was wondering, based on your findings, do you think patients who need pacemakers in this setting, which is basically most of them, should undergo an attempted atrial pacing? Or do you think the operator should just move on to V-pacing since so many of the leads either weren't able to be placed at the implant or were placed and then at later follow-up had non-capture? Or I was just wondering, or do you think maybe everybody should have a voltage map before in order to screen them to see if they are even a candidate for atrial pacing? I was just wondering how you are now approaching this. I mean, of course, none of us have a lot of these patients, but how would you approach a new patient if you met a new patient with atrial standstill?
Yeah, sure. I think you're correct in saying that these can be very challenging cases. So I think if you're coming in with a suspicion that the patient may have standstill, it is wise to do a voltage map of the right atrium at that time. I think with the modern multipole catheters that we use, it doesn't take much time, and it can definitely help you understand what you're up against. You can also try catheter-based pacing from islands of electrical activity and see if you're able to get a P wave. But if this does not work, you know, I'm not sure that there's a ton of utility in putting in an A lead, and I would probably go ahead with V pacing or ICD lead implant, whatever the patient calls for. It gets even actually more complicated, though, in epicardial pacemakers. We had several of these in our local experience. And again, we don't have a ton here. Nobody does. But we've had the surgeons try several locations, including left atrial positions, and had some rare success. But I think that in most patients within our cohort and that I've met, I think you should prepare to be disappointed with their ability to atrial pace.
I see. Well, for those in the audience, it's getting kind of late here on a Tuesday night. Dr. Howard was very, very kind to give us some time. So I'm going to finish up with one last question. You kind of talked a moment ago. You mentioned ICD leads. There were 4 cardiac arrest patients in your study, and you mentioned the special genetic factors in the paper that were associated with those particular patients. I'm wondering if you have any recommendations regarding primary ICD implementation in the atrial standstill patients group when you're encountering such a patient. How do you decide if somebody who's basically asymptomatic or maybe meets pacing symptoms criteria but hasn't had an event. How do you decide if they should have an ICD?
Yeah, this is a great question. So I approach this cautiously because our cohort is small, as you know. But when we looked at these patients in detail, it was those who had homozygous variants or who were compound heterozygotes that tended to be higher risk. And this is in SCN5A, loss of function mutations, to be specific. There were all patients who also had manifest Brugada patterns were also high risk. So I think if you have the luxury of genetic testing being back and you have a biallelic variant, either by a compound heterozygote or a homozygous patient, I think you should very carefully consider an ICD implant.
I see. Probably good advice. And I'm sure this is an evolving topic, right, as we learn more. Of course, your study is probably the largest in history on this topic, and you only had 20 patients, which I think speaks to the rarity of the condition. And so I think it's possible that some of the things we're saying tonight may not prove to be true in the future, but it is certainly the most most prominent and important information we have about it so far. And so for this, I congratulate you, Dr. Howard, and all of your many co-investigators in 8 centers throughout the world who all contributed cases to you. Congratulations, and thanks so much for joining us this week on the podcast. Great pleasure to have you.
It was the honor was mine, Dr. Pass. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you again.
Well, I think you all likely found Dr. Howard's comments very informative. He shared with us what makes this condition different than simple SA nodal dysfunction, and also offered to us some thoughts on what we might be doing in regards to anticoagulation for patients who have atrial standstill associated with other conditions that were not included in this cohort. He also offered for us a lot of practical advice regarding pacing these patients, including how to decide if they need one, who might be a candidate for an atrial lead, and perhaps most challenging of all, how can we best predict who might benefit from a primary prevention ICD in this setting? Obviously, we are somewhat limited in our ability to offer answers to these questions, given the very small numbers of patients upon which to make these recommendations, but I think you'll agree that his comments were quite prudent and reasonable, based upon our new knowledge of this rare condition from his paper. I'd once again like to thank Dr. Howard for taking time out of his busy schedule to speak with us this week. To conclude this 240th episode of PD Heart, we end with the love duet of Act 2 of the opera Ballo in Maschera by Giuseppe Verdi. And in this recent live performance, we hear the famed Lebanese-Canadian soprano Joyce El Khoury and the wonderful Chilean-American tenor Jonathan Tatelman. Both are rising superstars in the world of opera, and both sing the heck out of this wonderful love duet that is sometimes referred to by its first words, Teco Iosto. Thank you so much for joining me for this 240th episode, and thanks once again to Dr. Howard. I hope all have a wonderful week ahead.
Ah, strano di questo. Amelia, tu mami, Amelia, tu mami.